You come to Beverly Hills, California to visit with a charming lady, a delightful lady, whose name is Shirley Mitchell, and who contributed an awful lot to the golden age of radio in the role of Alice Darling on the Fibber McGee and Molly show, and Leela Ransom on The Great Gildersleeve, and so much more. I'm so happy to be here with
Thank
you today.
Thank you. It's really lovely having you here.
What was your very first radio experience?
You mean professionally?
Yes.
My first was when I was 13. I got on a bus and went to Detroit and auditioned for the Lone Ranger.
For the Lone Ranger?
Lone Ranger program. 13 years of age. It was really hysterical. I don't remember what the bus ride cost or anything, but
well, where
there
were you
I was.
Coming from?
From Toledo, which was my home.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to Detroit, and I think I had written them before then and asked them, could I come and audition? And they would have general auditions one day a week, right? What were they going to do with a 13-year-old kid from Toledo? But I auditioned, and by golly, they called me several weeks later and told me I had a job. So I got back on the bus and went to Detroit, and my check for that job was $3.50. I don't know that it paid for the bus fare, but that was my first experience. I held on to that check for years.
What did you do?
I don't even remember, Chuck. It was so long ago. Some little part. I don't think it was a child. They did a lot of Western families. It may have been, as a matter of fact. But that was my very first. And then, actually, I worked a little bit at WSPD in Toledo. That was for free as I was growing up. There was always an Uncle Jules. He had a Saturday morning show, and I did imitations on that. Mm-hmm. And then you would win, whoever would win the talent contest, and I did win. Then he was doing a weekly show in Toledo for free, and I used to do that occasionally. So that was where I got my early training. I mean, actually practical experience. But the first biggie was when I went to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of an involved story. Would you like to hear it?
I'd love to hear it. That's why we're here, yeah.
Yes. There was a director by the name of Joe Ainley who did all the soaps, Woman in White. I can't even remember the names of some of them. Betty Lou Gerson was his wife. Mm-hmm. When I got to Chicago, I had promised my parents I would stay 2 weeks and that if I didn't get work, I would come back and finish school and go into teaching of drama. So I sat around NBC and CBS and nothing happened. And finally, one day, I had been sitting there for quite a while. I mean, daily I would go make the rounds, as a lot of us did. And Betty Lou Gerson, who was the lead in Woman in White, kind of would nod each time. And I thought, what have I got to lose? Maybe she'll talk to me. So the next time I saw her, I asked her if she would mind hearing me, that I would like to just audition for her because I knew her husband was doing First Nighter. And she was so dear. She said she didn't have time that day, but the next day she would see me and we'd go into a little control room. She will corroborate the story. It was really what one actress did for another. She heard me. I did, you know, several readings. And I guess I had a real feel for comedy, which I was not aware of. But she recognized it. She went home and told Joe. She said, you must hear this kid. She's fabulous. We were just talking about this recently. So Joe said, okay, he would hear me. And indeed he did. She called me. I was living at the YWCA because I didn't have any money, and I knew that, you know, if it didn't work, I was going to have to leave. He heard me, and the following week he got me a job on the First Nighter. And curiously enough, the part was a Southern woman. That Southern I had picked up when I would go to the movies. I would invariably sit there all day, and I'd gotten Una Merkel in my head. She kind of had a soft talking and lisp with a S's, and I did that, and so he hired me to do a Southern part, and it was opposite Les Tremaine, and I think it was Wayne King and his orchestra. Do you remember? And they did the First Nighter in full dress in an actual theater in Chicago. I mean, you dressed Les wore tails. Well, can you imagine? That was the biggest thrill of my life. I'll remember what I wore. I remember how excited I was, how I thought I was going to faint before we ever got on the air. And that's when I started working, and started working in comedy. Then the next thing that happened was Ransom Sherman. I would go in and listen to Club Matinee every day because he was just terrific. I thought he was so funny. And I had a very loud laugh. And he began to take notice of me. And Fibber McGee and Molly, Kraft was coming to Chicago to replace a summer session of Fibber McGee and Molly, and they hired Ransom Sherman. And Ransom somehow arranged for Cecil Underwood, who was then the director, to meet with me. He heard me, and he hired me to do a part on the Ransom Sherman show. That was out of Chicago. that summer. I can't remember. It's quite a long time ago. But I did a little comedy thing, and at one point I had to say something about my slip was showing, and the audience began to scream, and in fact my slip was showing.
Oh.
So it got a tremendous laugh, and then they were coming back to Los Angeles. They did 13 weeks, and then Ransom was coming back. I don't remember exactly how it worked, but I thought, what have I got to lose? They're going back to L.A. This is my chance. So I bought myself a round-trip ticket on the Scout for $75, sat up for 4 nights, right? A lady on the train took pity on me, took me back to her house where I spent the first night, called Cecil and said, I'm here, are you going to use me? And he said, yes, we're going to use you this week, Tuesday night. And that was how I came to Hollywood.
Boy, that's you're a pretty spunky kid then, weren't you?
Wasn't I? Crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, only, I was 17.
Yeah.
Only a crazy kid without thinking of consequences. When I think back on it, I don't know how I did it. I lied to my parents. I told them I had a steady job. I was coming to L.A. Mm-hmm. I had a contract. There was no such thing. I didn't know where I was going to live. Those people drove me around. We arrived here on a Sunday. They drove me around Hollywood, where I booked a room at the Hollywood Towers, and that's where I stayed. But I never did cash that ticket in for about the first year. I was so sure that
I wasn't
was
gonna
not
going
to make it. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Well, what even with the by telling your parents that you had a steady job,
right?
I'm kind of surprised that they would just let a 17-year-old girl just.
They
okay,
really,
go ahead, you know.
I was very determined. They had no alternative. I mean, there wasn't much they could have done. I think that, when I think of the salaries, too, I think that that show paid then $32 a week. But I think my apartment in the Hollywood Towers was $32 a month. And I knew that I could make it. If I was able to do that show once a week, I was okay. And that, in fact, happened. You know, you can never explain things like that. They knew that I was determined to become an actress, and there was nothing they could do to stop me. Because I, one summer before then, I'd won a scholarship for a rep company in Plymouth, Massachusetts, called the Lakeshore Theater Colony. They didn't want me to go, so I locked myself up in the cellar for 2 days, and I said, that's it, I'm not coming out till I can go. And I waited on table that summer. So, you know, I was determined, plus I had the courage. I mean, I think I was just stupid. I can't imagine.
Well, the determination at that age is very important.
Oh, it's right.
And it keeps you going with it.
And that's exactly what it did. I was so convinced that I could make it.
Well, you did.
And I did, yeah.
So you were with then Ransom Sherman.
So I was with Ransom Sherman, right. And then Cecil, of course, went back to producing and directing Fibber and The Great Gildersleeve. And again, one role would occur because of another. I guess on the Ransom Sherman, I did a character called Veronica Valsey. It was a crazy character. But I also must have done Southern, because when they wrote the Southern part, they wrote a Southern part on Great Gildersleeve. He called and asked me to do it. And they had no idea of making that a central character. That just started out as a one-shot. So I did that first, and then, of course, she became Leela. And as a result of that, they hired me on to do Alice Darling on Fibber, McGee, and Molly. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I mean, I was just, you know, I was doing 4 and 5 comedy shows a day.
So when you say that character became Leela Ransom on the Gildersleeve program, in other words, it wasn't the Leela initially.
It was just a Southern gal that was going to that was visiting in town, and of course Gildy was a bachelor. I'd almost forgotten, but there's a society here called Spurdvac, and there are two blonde twins who are blind. They have every show taped I think that's ever been done. Just incredible kids. I've forgotten their names. They sent me Virginia Gregg and Irene Tedrow and Elvia Allman and Alice Backus, and I appeared there about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And as a thank you, they mailed me the first radio show I ever did out of Chicago, which was the Ransom Sherman show.
Oh,
Forgotten about it totally. And they sent me the first Gildersleeve show. And I had forgotten also that she was not Leela. She was just a lady who'd come to town, and Margie says, there's a lady getting out of a cab, and she's carrying a parasol. I mean, it was just the perfect description. They had great writers, John Whedon and Sam Moore, who were sensational. And the next week they said, how would you like to do that character again? And I said, I'd love it. And I loved her. She was just such a wonderful phony.
Yeah.
And they wrote her so magnificently.
Well, she was perfect for Gildersleeve,
too, because he
was
an
absolute...
He's such a corny.
absolute foil for her, right?
And on that one tape that I played recently, you know, I do it for my kids, and I get such a funny feeling. The voice is lighter, and it seems it's almost like deja vu. You think, oh, my gosh, was I really like that? But I just loved her. He sings Speak to Me of Love to her. You know, he would sing those chords. And she'd sigh through and do things like, oh, Throckmorton. It was really delicious. She was a great, great character.
Those shows were all done before a live audience.
Oh, sure, every one. And two shows, one for the East Coast and one for the West Coast, every Sunday.
With about 2 hours in between, I assume. Huh?
We would arrive at NBC at 9 a.m. in the morning, Sunday morning. We would rehearse, then I'd be home at noon to change and have something to eat, and back at NBC at 2. We did our first show, I think it was 2 or 2:30. I can't remember. No, it must have been later than that if I was back at 2, probably at 3. We would get cuts, then we'd go on the air, do that show for the East Coast. Then we had 2 hours off, and we'd usually go to the Derby and have dinner, the whole group, and do the second show at 6 or 6:30 or 7. I don't remember the exact.
Yeah, because initially Gildersleeve was on Sunday afternoons.
Sunday afternoons, right.
I can remember Chicago. It would be on around 5 or 5:30.
Yeah, that's about right then.
Sure. Now, did you stay with Gildersleeve throughout that period of time when you were working with Fibber McGee?
Yes.
Where you were doing two shows.
I was doing those two. I would occasionally have four shows a day. I mean, a day. Some would be at CBS. There were times when the artist entrance was too far for me to run through. They'd have a special page holding a door because the timing was so awful. I mean, it was, you know, maybe 5 minutes apart to get from CBS to NBC. And then they would hold a special
door.
You were
running down Sunset Boulevard.
Down Sunset Boulevard. Well, they would let me park usually at a spot because, and sometimes I would run and cut through the back way. The page would have the door open. I'd get in. Somebody would hand me a script with cuts in it. You always had cuts because the timing was done at the last minute. And I'd go on the air because I also then began to do on Sunday afternoons the Colgate Comedy Hour. Les Tremaine and I did that for a couple of seasons with Bob Crosby. I would do that and Gildersleeve. Fibber was on a Tuesday.
Right.
And I would occasionally do Fibber on a Tuesday and then the Jack Carson show on a Tuesday. Then there was Joan Davis and Rudy Vallee in between all of that.
And all the stuff was going on at the same time.
At NBC and CBS. It was such an exciting time. The fans would be lined up in front. You know, I don't know. Have you been down? Of course you have, on Vine Street in Hollywood.
Sure.
The fans would be lined up for a block. Maybe, all the way around, waiting to get in. They'd let them in a half hour before the show. And at the artist entrance, you had the same fans every day who, you know, they grew up. I mean, I met one lady in Hughes recently shopping, and she said, do you remember me? And she recognized me because I've done quite a bit of television. But it was the most glorious time. I'm sure you've gotten that from every radio actor, haven't you?
Yes, virtually everyone we've spoken to has said the same thing. It was really the best of times.
Incredible.
People who have certainly gone into even greater success in television,
right,
they've always said it was so great because, first of all, you didn't have to deal with the makeup and
that's
the costumes and all of that, even though you did dress
for
a nighttime show.
Sure. But no, and we were a family. Mm-hmm. We still are very, very close. Janet Waldo and I are very close friends, Ginny, Greg, Elvia Allman. It's just, it was a nucleus of people that you never grew away from. And they were dear, wonderful people. And television, you know, you do a show, you never see anybody again.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a totally different
There
feeling.
Is a real, you're right, a family feeling
to
it.
Oh, yes.
And I know that all the radio performers do continue to keep in touch with
we
one
do,
another.
We do, all of us.
Very much.
Well,
so.
Pacific Pioneer Broadcast, have you ever seen anything like that?
Incredible.
Isn't
700 people come to one of
Eight,
those
Eight, nine?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most incredible thing, and we just lost Ken Carpenter, you know, died last week.
Sorry to hear
who also announced a lot of the shows that I did. Wonderful, wonderful man.
Now, you were doing, you said Jack Carson.
Yeah, I did Jack Carson for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, what character did you play in?
A girlfriend. I was always somebody's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Now I'm always somebody's neighbor. That's how
You were I think, on The Life of Riley, too, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, with Bill Bendix.
And that was Gillis's... I think you were, Honeybee?
Southern, yeah, on that show. I'd almost forgotten about that. Sure, worked with Bill a lot. He was actually married to, his wife in that series was Gloria Blondell on radio, and then in TV it was Margie Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
the actress, whom I see occasionally out on interviews.
Now, you went to TV with Gildersleeve, didn't you?
No.
You didn't
go with Gildersleeve on TV? I didn't go with Gildersleeve. I went on TV with Joan Davis.
On I Married Joan.
On I Married Joan. That was the first fairly regular series I did. And then from there... No, isn't that curious? I never did do The Widow. I think they pictured her... I could do her now. Mm. I think they pictured her as older.
Oh, I see.
And somehow it just didn't work.
Well, it was funny when McGee went to TV. Now, Jim and Marion Jordan did not go to TV with Fibber McGee and Molly.
No.
And it didn't last very long because it became a crazy sitcom and not the real wonderful writing and everything
you
else.
You know, Chuck,
from the
radio I don't even
show.
Remember that.
Well, it was Kathy Lewis and Bob Sweeney as Fibber and Molly.
Who was one of my closest friends. It was Kathy. See, I don't even remember. Yeah. That must have been before my friend Irma that Kathy did with the blonde.
Well, Marie Wilson. Kathy was doing Irma, Jane Stacy on radio with Marie Wilson as Irma.
That's right.
And I think Diana Lynn went to television with Marie Wilson for My Friend Irma. If I'm not mistaken.
I don't even remember that.
But when Gildersleeve, or rather Fibber, went to TV, Hal Perry came in there, but Hal Perry was playing a next-door neighbor, or he was playing Fred Nitney or something. He didn't play Gildersleeve. But by that time, Willard Waterman had taken over the role of Gildersleeve on radio. Were you ever on the Gildersleeve series with Waterman?
Sure. Uh-huh. I did the series with him.
You really stayed with that for the most long time, didn't you?
Most of the time. After I had a baby, I was back on it because Willard was doing it.
You mentioned Una Merkel before, and she played for a sequence of shows on Gildersleeve.
When I got married, she came on as my cousin, as Lita's cousin. That was really ironic because I picked up that Southern accent from her, and she later came on the show to play it. Isn't that interesting? The world turns.
What about one of the most asked questions that I get about the radio people?
Mm-hmm.
Is about Walter Tetley, who played Leroy on the show, and there's not, unfortunately, I've never had the opportunity. I know he died in a, wasn't it a motorcycle accident or something?
No, I don't. Well, maybe I know that he was ill for quite a long time. Was it? You know what?
It may have been a result of something.
That's what happened. Yes, I didn't see him once he was in the hospital.
No, he stayed on that show for.
As long as
almost
it existed.
You're right, the length of the show. And then he was with Phil and Alice, too.
That's right. Uh-huh. He was on that with Elliot Lewis, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. He was fabulous. He was really an interesting actor. But that voice and that timing was impeccable.
It was perfect. He just...
Yeah.
Now, he was what I guess you would call a little people today? Was he a...
See, he was such a dichotomy. No, he was not... tiny.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite tall, but there must have been an endocrine deficiency. In other words, he never shaved, and his voice obviously never changed. But he was about 5'10", 5'9". That's not short.
No, not at all.
So, as I say, I think there was an endocrine deficiency, and by the time they realized it, it was just too late to do anything about it. But
how old... a person was he when he was doing Gildersleeve?
Chuck, I have no idea. He would never tell any of us. I would say that he was, 20s?
I have tapes of him with Fred Allen in the old Town Hall Tonight program,
you know what?
Which is
he
late
30s. Sure,
see?
He was older than 20. That's what I say. Yeah. You could never tell his age because he had, it was a youthful appearance, but you knew somehow it was just off kilter. Uh-huh. Do you know what I'm saying?
But he had that high-pitched kid voice, clear as a bell.
Absolutely.
And you're right, the timing, his timing.
Oh, impeccable. Yeah. I've never known anyone that had timing like that.
Yeah.
He was just an incredible actor. You're right. If he was on with Fred Allen in the 30s, then he could very well have been in the 30s
when I knew him. That wasn't old anyway.
For a kid who should have been, what, 10 or 11?
Yeah. Well, he did that voice with, not did that voice, that was his voice, but he worked with Phil and Alice into 54 or something like that. And, of course, Gildersleeve.
Absolutely. No, I have no idea. Isn't that weird? In a strange sense, it's a way of, I guess, keeping young forever. You couldn't.
Well,
he could still be doing that voice, right?
Mm-hmm. He probably could. Yeah, yeah.
He was
still doing the same.
He was just fabulous.
You played the mouse on radio once.
The Gary and the Mouse, right?
Yeah.
With Wendell Corey out here, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to New York and I did the Tales of Willie Piper with
William.
Billy Redfield,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
He died as well. Mm-hmm. He was another wonderful actor. Yes, I did. How do you remember McGarry and the Mouse?
Well, we have rays.
Oh, that is so funny. I'd forgotten all about that.
And you worked, I think, with Bill Goodwin for a while, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, Bill and Philippa became very close friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Bill
mm-hmm.
died, unfortunately, too young.
You made a nice transition to television.
Yes, I was fortunate.
All of this sort of thing?
Yeah, I really did. Especially in the early days of television because they didn't have too many actors around who could learn lines rapidly and do comedy. You know, that took a while. But I fell right in with Joan, and from I Married Joan, I Love Lucy
mm-hmm.
became
mm-hmm.
one of the club women. But they still, you know, they replay that
They're running constantly, yeah.
Then I'm trying to remember what other... Oh, the Jack Benny Show, all of his specials I did, because I replaced Sarah Berner as one of the telephone operators.
Oh, uh-huh.
So Bea Benaderet and I did...
On the TV things.
On the TV.
Yeah.
Did all the TV specials. Then Danny Kaye, Danny Thomas, Joey Bishop, and Dick Van Dyke. So that transition was very simple because, as I say, there weren't too many supporting players who knew comedy who could work three-camera shows in front of an audience and not fall apart. You know, it's like a tiny little play that you do, and there's no
And you just do it,
error.
Boom, in one,
oh,
and
yeah,
away it goes.
That's
yeah.
it. They would do retakes sometimes if there was a big, you know, a terrible thing might happen and somebody really couldn't remember his lines.
Were you on a regular on... Please Don't Eat the Daisies?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just spoke to Pat before you came over. We're very, very close. Yeah, that's an unusual relationship. We have remained very, very close friends.
And there was a spinoff from a TV series called December Bride that became Pete and Gladys.
That's right.
And you did some work
and
on that.
And I did. I was her next-door neighbor on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my transition is interesting, isn't it? First I was the girlfriend. Then I became the next-door neighbor. Now I'm the mother-in-law. I'm not the grandmother yet, but close. Because
well, I think you could still be the next-door neighbor, and you could probably be the girlfriend without
you. Oh, thank you. Come on. Flattery will get you everywhere. But December Bride, the Spring Byington show, who and Jerry Thorpe, who's become a very well-known director-producer, was the son of Richard Thorpe, who was a director at MGM. He was the one who tested me for Please Don't Eat the Daisies and hired me on to do The Neighbor on that show. Mm-hmm. And then he found a pilot. They were going to make a pilot. Do you remember Marion Hargrove, who wrote a book called See Here, Private Hargrove? They did, MGM did a pilot in which I would have done the lead, the mother of a 16-year-old boy, but it didn't work. Unfortunately, that would have been terrific. It was the wrong timing. Later on it might have, but not at that time.
What have you done on the motion picture screen?
Not a lot, actually. I did a little thing in Desk Set, the Spencer Tracy Catherine Hepburn film. I did a little thing on the Diana Barrymore story. I played Murray Hamilton's wife, mm-hmm. played the agent. I haven't done much in pictures, actually, Chuck, because, you know, I've been really busy. It's hard to divert your time if you concentrate on television. And now I'm into commercials, so that's very time-consuming. And films, the parts get fewer and fewer, yeah. and they're mm-hmm. very tiny.
Theatrically, how about, have you done much work on the stage?
No, I've just joined mm-hmm. Theater West, which is in the Valley, mm-hmm. and I may do something out there.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
good.
They do some nice work, mm-hmm. so I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Now, you mentioned commercials. Now, where might we see you, or
well,
is it voiceover?
Well, I think there's
both?
A bird's eye. No, no, that's on camera. Mm-hmm. There's a bird's eye that's still running. I don't know what in Chicago, because some are regional and
yeah,
some are
right.
national. El Paso Frozen Foods, I did. But I've been fairly fortunate in commercials, because they do, you do very nicely with those. Mm-hmm. And a lot of voiceovers
uh-huh.
well,
in
that's
radio.
Good. Yeah.
That's good. That's
yeah.
good. I want to talk finally about Fibber McGee and Molly, because that is
yes.
one of our favorite shows.
Are you going to let me say happy birthday to Jim on your special show?
Of course you can.
Happy birthday, Jim. I love you. He is. What a darling. Go ahead, ask me.
You worked with, I think at a time when you came in on the Fibber McGee and Molly show, Gail Gordon had left the cast to go into the, I think he went into the Coast Guard or something like that. They were looking for additional players on the series to take up some of the slack of some of these other roles.
But no, he was doing Mayor La Trivia. And then mm-hmm. This must have been after the Coast Guard.
You came in during the war because you were a boarder, weren't you?
Right,
you,
Alice Darling. Yeah. You worked in a defense plant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. But I thought Gail was on it, Chuck.
Well, he
maybe
may have
for a while.
There may have been a slight transition.
Yes, right,
in
right,
there.
Right.
But it was, you said it was fun to do that show.
Oh, it was just wonderful. And you know who else? You helped me recall. Who was the man who did the high voice that they brought? Beulah?
Oh, Marlon Hurt.
Marlon Hurt from uh-huh. Chicago, wasn't
right.
he?
Right, yeah, sure.
He came on the show while I was on it, and he did Beulah, and then that spun off into his own show, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. became very successful. And then Bill, who did the old-timer?
Thompson, Bill Thompson.
Yeah, Bill Thompson was doing the old-timer. Mm-hmm. Was Arthur Q. Bryan doing a
character? He was Doc Gamble.
Right.
See, Doc Gamble was
right.
a major addition to the cast, I believe,
when Gail left.
Because
yes.
you have that,
right.
that conflict between the
yes,
Fibber and somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
Because Ethel, oh, what was Ethel's last name? The woman who did the kind of high, do you know?
Oh, Mrs.
Wolfington.
Wolfington or something,
something
like that.
Something like
yeah,
that,
okay.
yeah. She was
Uppington,
not on
yeah.
Mrs. Uppington.
Uppington yeah.
yeah, she was not on it when I did it. She mm-hmm. had all, I don't know where she was, or she had quit or something. Because that was why they brought Alice in. I didn't do that. I think I did it two seasons. Is that right?
It may have been a couple
yeah,
of seasons. It was always a bright spot on that show, though.
Really?
It sure was,
thank
sure.
You.
It was interesting that the McGees would have a boarder, you know.
Yes.
I mean, they
yes.
had a maid for a while and no visible means of employment. But then Ozzie Nelson did that for years, too.
Oh,
so
that was another show I did all the time. Oh, sure, Ozzie and Harriet, and I also did the television mm-hmm. thing of that a lot. But I did their radio show a lot. No, that's right. No visible means of support. And poor Harriet, who hated to sing, would have to get up and sing on the radio show, and it would just kill her. She really had a thing about singing. She would get so nervous. Oh, and I thought about Skelton. I did that all the time.
Did a lot of Red Skelton shows.
And a lot of the television. Mm-hmm. That was, I want to tell you, I paid my dues. Red was the most vital performer and strictly off the top of his head. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you couldn't work with him, forget about lines. You know, you did the lines, you rehearsed it, you did a preview at CBS, and when you finished, the next time you went to do the show, it was totally different. And he would go off on a tangent where he would leave the script, go off on his own, and you just had to be ready. I mean, you just had to pray that the cue, you were going to hear something that was even close to the cue. So I did that show a lot because he trusted me. He was fabulous.
I'd like to tell you a little bit more about some of the war stories from the radio days, and the fun times and the anecdotes and some of the things that may have happened to you in the course of performing. I'm going to take just a little break. We're talking with Shirley Mitchell on our Those Were the Days program.